the fifth meeting with, the fifth interview session with Michael Matrinko took place in Alexandria, Virginia on March 2nd, 1989.
At our last meeting, you talked about how the BBC ran stories about demonstrations in Tabriz and elsewhere that were untrue. Why do you think they were doing that? Did you have a fix on that at the time?
I have no idea if it was conscious policy. Lots of Iranians, lots of the old upper class, the loyal to the Shah Iranians, blame, of course, the BBC for doing just that. The Shah himself blamed the BBC for doing that and summoned the British ambassador to talk to him about it. It may have just been for the same reasons that other news was misprinted or misreported. So many people claiming so many varying and contradictory events. Some of it wishful thinking, others purposeful. Purposeful confusion, disinformation. It was going on all over the place. It may have been just a simple matter of that. BBC is not infallible. It's a high news agency, just like any other. Subject to making the same mistake.
Okay. Now, at also the last meeting, you discussed some of your contacts with various revolutionary groups in Tehran and elsewhere. To what extent did your contacts extend to Tudor Party members or individuals who were close to the Tudor Party?
I never met anybody who claimed he was a member of the Tudor Party. Certainly, up until the revolution, nobody would have said that. After the revolution, they were still being a little bit leery about it, or wary about it. I have met in Iran people who claimed they were communists, did not use the name Tudor. Basically, contacts were one time, you know, I never followed up any contacts like that.
What was your assessment of the two-day party?
My assessment today or my assessment then?
Then
that it was really a dead issue. Although, one thing I might say, there were quite a few, not the two-day party, but the former communist regimes in Iran, specifically the Peshavari government in Tabriz, was not unfavorably looked at by many people in Tabriz. Quite a number of people, some of the older people from Tabriz, the Azerbaijan, spoke favorably of it in private. It had apparently done quite a bit for the people in the area.
Social reform agenda.
Like that, asphalting roads, electrification. And I remember once an older Iranian friend, a Turkish Iranian from Azerbaijan, that I met at one of the universities when I was teaching in the Peace Corps days, who were discussing Turkish, and he could read and write in Turkish as well as speak it. And I asked him how we had learned, and he said, oh, I grew up in, went to school in Tabriz during the Peshavari period. And he said, Turkish became our official language. We were able to teach it and learn it in school. And he said, of course, that changed when the Shah came back. This was something that for him had been very beneficial for learning of Turkish. I mean, the, you know, learning to become literate in it. Iranians were basically not literate in it, and books in Persian Turkish were rather difficult to find. So that was the sort of thing that Peshavari had done. The Tabrizis.
That's interesting. Now, also, I think at one of our last meetings, you said that Governor Carter, the State Department, was basically accepting of the revolution in Iran. Now, in August 79, Bruce Lang and Chargé cabled Washington that, and this is a quote, that an underlying problem for us has been the fact that much of the new leadership does not yet perceive that we have accepted the change in Iran. And ends the quote. He went on to say that some of that was tactical, the need to keep revolutionary credentials intact. What do you think explained the Iranians' perception that the Carter administration did not altogether accept the revolution?
A number of things. First of all, you had the remnants of the Heiser mission. General Heiser had come to Iran, and his mission had been a bit disorganized and a bit unclear. he wasn't sure if he was supposed to arrange a tour or prevent one. Brzezinski thought he was being sent there to arrange one. Carter, as far as I can see, thought that Eiser was there to prevent one unless he had to arrange one. It was all rather unclear. But certainly Heiser's mission had been well known in Iranian circles and was much discussed by military figures who were put on trial during the course of the summer of 1979. General Rabi'i, the former head of the Iranian Air Force, who had been one of General Heiser's chief contacts for his month or so in Iran in January of 1979. General Rabi'i spoke quite a bit about this mission. So you had the continuing stories coming out of the trial, continuing revelations coming out from, you know, Army, Navy, Air Force, Sovok, who were spilling their guts as they were being tried. Certainly the confessions that were being extorted in prison from people, some politicians, etc. You had incidents like Senator Javits standing up in the Senate in 1979 and berating Iran.
When Al-Ghani was executed.
Al-Ghani. I still think it was rather funny because, as far as I know, Senator Javits' wife was a paid political agent for the Shah. For the Iranians to look at things like this, it was also a tremendous amount of anti-Khomeini publicity, with good reason, in the United States in the newspapers. The Iranians have always claimed, as many third world countries do, not to be able to understand the concept of a free press. The Shah screamed at the British ambassador because he felt the British government was totally responsible for BBC. Khomeini's government did the same thing because they thought the British government was responsible for BBC. The French were blamed for, Agence France-Presse. The Germans were blamed for the German press. The Americans were blamed for the American press. And you had all sorts of weird incidents happening that they thought were either insulting to the revolution or anti-revolution or pro-Shah or whatever. They paid very close attention to what was being written in the American press and what was being said in the American media. And there was an awful lot of fuel there to give them the impression that we were against the revolution. There was also the fact that a lot of the old Shah people, I don't mean the Shah himself at this point, but certainly lots of others, the Zemlya, the Kerner, were busily escaping and popping up in the United States. There was, from their point of view, reason to think there was anti-revolution.
I've got a question about domestic political system in Iran. Yes. Now, in September 1979 letter back to the State Department, economic officer Andrew Sens, S-E-N-S, stated that he disagreed, this is a quote, with our position that there is a dual government, that is to say, Bazargan and Khomeini. I suspect the dual government analysis analytical construct is popular because it implies that we can influence at least part of the policy machinery. In other words, if there's a dual government of Bazargan and Khomeini, we can influence Bazargan at least, if not Khomeini. He goes on to say, but to contend that Khomeini is the only real source of power means we then have to explain how that we can protect our interests here. Let me read this. To say that to contend that Khomeini is the only real source of power means we then have to explain how it is we can protect our interests here only by indirect communications to a third party. Obviously not in sympathy with us on many questions. End of quote. The implication is that the U.S.
it's
convoluted, but the implication seems to be that the U.S. has some kind of, there's a third party that's working with the U.S. in talks with Khomeini. At this stage in the fall?
That's one thing. I'm not sure what Andy had in mind. I know that he disagreed with our view of the security situation and thought that things were much better than many of our reports suggested.
Is that so?
Now, if we disagree with the dual government concept, I think facts and history have not borne out his opinion. Anyone who watched Khomeini, you know, sort of, I mean, who watched the Bazargan retreat and then resigned abruptly in November of 79, you know, could see that the analysis of dual government was correct, that Bazargan was a facade that was being used by the clergy who really had the power.
Mm-hmm.
Bazargan was a pathetic creature. I remember him on television complaining because some members of his own office had been arrested right in front of him. This, it's like an American politician who won't resign even when he's been an embarrassment to his own party or to his own leaders. Bazargan at that point was an embarrassment. You have, you know, as far as dealing with Khomeini, you have to remember that we were dealing with, you know, his appointed deputies, both religious deputies as well as civilians. We certainly had quite a decent, you know, daily relationship with the Minister of Foreign Affairs and other ministers, you know, the Deputy Prime Minister, the Prime Minister, it goes on like that. We saw them regularly, or as regularly as any other embassy did. And we had a whole series of meetings with various members of the clergy. We were dealing rather closely with the Talagani Committee. Talagani was a member of the Revolutionary Committee. We were dealing, I don't want to say intimately or too closely, with the Heshti, but we had meetings with the Archbishop, Archbishop Heshti, yes, I suppose he said, with Ayatollah Heshti, you know, and other clergy like that. If Khomeini had wanted to deal with us, we already had the framework there for it.
So when Sense talks about relying on third parties, not really talking about the reality of the situation at all.
Don't forget that at that point, no government was really in touch with Khomeini. The PLO thought it was and wasn't. The French thought they were and weren't. You know, others thought they were and would go back and forth.
Now, on some accounts of U.S. policy during the Revolution, Richard Cottam's name comes up because of his long-standing contacts with the moderate revolutionaries like Bazargan. From your perspective at the time, how influential was Cottam?
The name never came up. I mean, another one of the many academics who had done books on Iran in the past. Everybody knew Iranians in the government. We didn't particularly mean academics, you know, in that sense, to run passes for us or anything else. Especially people who had really not been in Iran in quite a while and didn't have too much of an idea of how much blood was being spilled. Their moderate friends were just as much on the outs as anybody else was.
Now in his book, James Bill mentions that the embassy provided some assistance to supporters of the old regime who were trying to leave the country. How much and what kind of support was given?
To the best of my knowledge, the only sort of support, and this is not really support, would have been visas for some of the people in our family. But we were doing that for a large number of people, everything from homeless students to businessmen.
No special assistance in leaving the country besides
we
just giving.
We didn't have any ability to do that.
Yeah.
I mean, how could we have done that sort of thing?
Now, according to the James Bill's book, as well as other sources, by the summer of 79, the U.S. was much more visible in Iran, and embassy officials making more contacts with Iranians at all levels of society. He also notes that many Iranians worried about these efforts because it suggested an effort by the U.S. to restore its position of influence.
That was our whole point.
Yes. Now, how much did you know about those concerns that the U.S. was perhaps being overactive in its efforts to reestablish a presence in the country?
Our efforts to reestablish relationships, mm-hmm. to maintain, to reestablish, or to newly establish, to make new relationships. Mm-hmm. For active, they went on as they would in any embassy. Mm-hmm. As we tried to get embassy business done, as we tried to make our views known, as we tried to establish a relationship with the new government. Mm-hmm. That's normal embassy business. It's not bad. This is what embassies do. Mm-hmm. This is how you get information and get your job done. It was met by an equal, in fact, I'd say, an even higher desire, a greater desire on the part of many of the new officials to quickly establish working relations with us. They wanted technical aid, they wanted other aid, they wanted visas, they wanted information. They wanted to be able to go to the United States, they wanted the possibility of assistance, and they wanted the continuation of military aid, just as the old Shaw's government had. At least many of them did.
Mm-hmm.
This is normal. Now, did this bother some Iranians? Yes, it did. It bothered a number, a fair amount, obviously, who were very revolutionary and thought that they could get the United States totally out of Iran, that the United States should be totally out of Iran. Mm-hmm. It presumably bothered Khomeini. Certainly the ones who went around saying neither east nor west and all those other silly political slogans, it would have bothered. I've had Iranians tell me that, I haven't tell me that it bothered them. That comments directed at me. And they thought that I couldn't understand, and even when they didn't care if I understood. What are the Americans still doing here? We thought we got rid of them, that sort of thing. Would the fact that they were bothered have stopped us? No. Nor should it have.
Okay.
Iranians are super sensitive about too many things. And their sensitivities are often childish.
Now, during the summer of 70, also during the summer of 79, the State Department sent a closely held cable to Bruce Langdon asking for an assessment of the consequences if the U.S. admitted the Shah to the country. Did you know about this cable at the time? I think it was around June, early July, perhaps.
The specific cable, no, but I certainly talked to Bruce Langdon about what various friends of mine were saying. Not necessarily Bruce. I may have discussed this with Victor Tomczak. I'm not sure which one it was. What I was getting from some of my friends, including some pretty revolutionary friends, was that it didn't make any difference anymore. That he was gone, that he was finished, and they didn't care what happened to him. And these are people who were bona fide members of the revolutionary movement. Mm-hmm.
So to that extent, there was no real concern that the U.S. admitted the Shah, that would have necessarily bad implications?
There were some people who were saying, yes, it would cause a problem.
Yeah, yeah.
But that was one of those things that was still unclear.
As of the early summer,
when the Shah had been admitted to Mexico, the Iranian government had raised a squawk, and the Mexicans had basically told them to mind their own business, that it was a domestic Mexican affair.
Okay.
And the Iranians had shut up about it.
Yeah, let's come up again in a little bit.
Yeah.
Now, also during the summer, probably even before the summer of 79, there was considerable violence against the Kurds because of their demands for provincial autonomy.
Yes.
Did you learn much about this development from your Kurdish friends?
Yes,
or from other sources as well?
A lot of the violence in Kurdistan had nothing to do with demands for autonomy and nothing to do with the revolution. It was simply the sheer joy of looting and the sheer joy of fighting and getting something that you didn't own last week. But, of course, a lot of the revolution was derived from, certainly was an important part of the revolution, this desire to grab, steal, or loot something. That's true in every revolution, especially true in Iran. The Kurdish troubles, we had no officers in that area. We heard some stuff about it. A lot of it was in the press. But you know, what more can I say about it? It was pretty well covered even in the national press at the time. And certainly some of the Kurdish religious leaders. The trouble in Kurdistan is a mixture of things. You had, on the one hand, all the accusations of anti-revolutionary activity and specific charges by the Iranian central government and by the press that various old Shah officials were raising trouble in Kurdistan. I mean, they complained a great deal and they charged that General Palizban, P-A-L-I-Z-B-A-N, that Kurdish ethnic general who had been the last military commander, the last civilian commander, the last governor general of Kermanshah province. They charged that he was fomenting anti-revolutionary activity and fighting in the court in the Kurdish area. They said the same thing about various other people. They remember at one point, Yazdi, Minister of Foreign Affairs, even complained that there was a whole group of suspicious Americans, or had been a whole group of suspicious Americans, doing something, you know, spy activity in the village of Nakhadeh.
In Kurdistan.
In Kurdistan. Yeah. Nakhadeh, of course, as we pointed out to him, was the site of a very large and very, very world-famous archaeological site that had been developed by the University of Pennsylvania, and they all left the year before, during the revolution. So, but you had this sort of accusation. Activity in Kurdistan ranged from simple villagers fighting villagers to get each other's property through some anti-revolutionary or counter-revolutionary activity, through demands for autonomy, through the general sort of chaos that was going on all over Iran, where people make lots of noise, bang bang with their guns, and didn't know what in hell they wanted. But it was the whole mixture.
But there was some state repression against
they bombed some of their own towns. One of the first missions the Iranian Air Force was sent on by the central government was to bomb the town of Mahabad. The anti-Kurdish activity by the central government started immediately. If you'll recall the pictures then, this happened in 79, you know, a whole number of Kurds were executed, including some. One case, a group of Kurdish doctors and nurses were executed for treating people who had been injured by the central government forces. A lot of that got hotter after the hostage situation went on in the 1980s, especially 80-81, and there was some really serious fighting in the Kurdish area.
Well, some have argued that Khomeini overreacted to the whole Kurdish situation because of his, so he could use the use it as a lever to strengthen his version of Islamic control. Was there some thing to that?
Yeah. A lot of the Kurds were Sunni, to begin with.
Yeah.
Some of the Kurdish religious leaders, Sheikh Izzeddine Hosseini, were anti-Khomeini. There was a fair amount of trouble there. And the Kurds saw a chance to gain some independence. They had been suppressed for a long time by the previous regime. This regime had made promises to them. Promises were not being kept, and the Kurds revolted once more.
Okay. Now, this one thing you might have alluded to this the last at one of our earlier meetings, but according to some accounts that I've seen, around September 79, the American Embassy Committee that was protecting the embassy, protecting the quotes, I guess, this committee was disbanded, and the Revolutionary Guards took over embassy protection. What accounted for that change?
No, not the Revolutionary Guards.
Oh, okay.
Just a quick chronology.
Yeah.
When the embassy was first attacked on February 14th, 1979, three groups of security guards were sent to the embassy compound to protect it.
Yeah.
There was one group that was basically Air Force, Air Force Home Affairs. They had control of about one-third of the compound, and they lived in the former police barracks, which we had in our compound. There was another group which had been sent by the Central Committee These were the Marshal Lacan and his group. They were down at the main gate. And the third group sent by Foreign Minister Yang Zi. They were headquartered in the ambassador's residence and controlled that area.
Okay.
In the course of time, the Air Force group pulled out, and I'm not sure any longer of lengths of time, but for about a month or two, perhaps longer, the other two security forces stayed there. Constant rivalry and tension between them, to the point of open fighting. And even when Ambassador Sullivan left Tehran, there was fighting over that. He was protected in his exit out by one committee, or one group, that purposely did not tell the other, thinking they might believe it, and with good reason, might be trouble. Eventually, Mashallah's security group got rid of the other group.
The Yazdi group.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And as time went on, the police were able to move in, and Mashallah's group was removed. There was some fighting and some fisticuffs over that, but I no longer remember exactly a long time ago now.
So the city police were
The police,
job.
Yeah.
Does that make any difference in terms of security at the embassy? The
when
police
things
were
quiet
doing,
outside, we had good security inside. When things were noisy outside, security decreased. We no longer had the sort of quiet, well-run, orderly, manicured compound that Middle East posts used to have, what used to have in Iran. In 1979, it was no longer possible. It was more like a Middle Eastern circus.
So the local police were the security people up through the November crisis.
Yeah.
Now, September 79, the State Department sent another message to Bruce Langen about admitting the shot to the U.S., raising the whole question of what the implications were in terms of foreign policy and the domestic situation. Did you see that cable or know about that particular cable or other series of cables?
I just don't remember.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't forget, that was the sort of thing where the political confidant, the concept, would have seen it. Well, we all would have seen it in the reading. He would have discussed it, but it's hard to remember after 10 years.
Yeah.
Which things I saw and things I didn't see. I can't even remember the ones that I wrote.
But was this a subject of a fairly constant discussion at the embassy?
Yes, absolutely.
But along the lines you mentioned a few minutes ago, that there was some division as to the implication.
Lots of talk about it.
Yeah.
What would happen, but in the sort of intellectual sphere. I've always felt a bit of disagreement with other people from the embassy who complain or who say that they told Carter, they said that this would happen.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it was simply cover their asses afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
People talked about this. No one that I know of acted on the belief that if the Shah were to be let into the United States, we'd be in serious trouble. Let me give you an example. If the people in the embassy had really believed it was serious trouble against the embassy, I think they would have taken some steps to remove embassy documents, embassy files, to bring the embassy down to minimal staffing. There were all sorts of things that could have been done. To sort of have a bank vacation, that sort of thing for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Would have been very, very simple to do. And any excuse could have been used, whether it was reconstruction, whatever. There was lots, that's why I say there was talk about it, but only on the intellectual level.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody really paid attention to what it might really mean.
Including yourself?
Including myself, I'm guilty as anyone else. But I was up in the air about it. I didn't know if there would be trouble. I really didn't think there would be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And all the files have been brought back, right, from Washington. Or a great number of files, right? During the summer. During the summer.
Files. I don't think they ever left the embassy.
I think somebody was shipped back temporarily.
No.
I read that some were shipped back and then they were sent back again.
None that I ever knew were shipped out. At least not in our section, in the political section.
Okay. Mm-hmm. About the fall of 79, say September, October, what was your assessment of U.S. relations with Iran? How did you think things stood at that stage?
Spotty, getting better. We were certainly getting better with the provisional government.
Mm-hmm.
And with Fazlur Ghani's group, there were hundreds of thousands of Iranians who wanted to go to the United States. There was lots of interest in the United States and what was happening in Iran. Assistance programs looked as though they might be picking up again. There was an awful lot of chaos in the streets and a lot of security trouble. But it wasn't all directed against us, it was affecting everybody.
Okay.
The country was still running on an adrenaline high. And Khomeini was as bizarre as he was later to prove. But other than that, not all that bad. There was an awful lot of anti-American rhetoric, but there was anti-everything rhetoric.
Mm-hmm. What was your take on the Bazargan government? Did you think it was weakening? Was it fairly, seemed fairly stable at that point?
It seemed as stable as it had any right to be.
Yeah.
And it looked as though they might be able to pull it off. Although it was clear to everybody that there were other people in the country with real power. You know, in the telegram we discussed on the security situation in Iran, it's pretty clear that there were lots of security problems, and a government has to be able to control the security in the country. It doesn't. It's not really an effective government. The Bazargan government was there in Tehran, but in lots of places there were still lots of problems, and it looked like they weren't getting any better. There was still an awful lot that stood it up.
On October 22nd, 79, the Shah flew to New York for medical treatment. Did you know that this would happen? Were you given advance notice?
Yes. But I don't really remember what we did. I think we may have closed the embassy down for a day or two. I think it was over a weekend, but I'm really not sure anymore.
Yeah.
What was the date again?
October 22nd, 1979. Yeah. Give or take a day.
Yeah.
What was your reaction when you heard that?
My reaction was, so what?
Did you have any discussions with your contacts about the Shah's arrival in the U.S.? Or what did people say to you when they heard this? Your Iranian
that
friends.
Much interest in it, yeah. Actually, in my friends.
Yeah.
Most
of
them didn't care. He was already something. You know, the position of Shah was of importance to the politicos, to the old Shah supporters, the high officials. And to some of the people who were still rabidly anti-monarch in the new government. But most people just did not give a damn. In a lot of ways, all of the emotion about the Shah's arrival in the United States was an artificial, made-up cause celebre. It's like the cause celebre that's made of Salman Rushdie's book. No one in Iran has read it. They don't care about it. But it's a political thing that they have to beat.
Also in his recent book, James Bill argues that the managers of the Chase Manhattan Bank might have pushed the Shah's admission to the United States in the hope of provoking a diplomatic crisis that would help the bank protect its exposed financial position in Iran. They made many loans in the late 70s, and there was some concern about the security of those loans. Had there been any discussion at the embassy about the Chase Bank's financial problems or its exposed position?
Not that I knew of, but if that were true, I would think they'd be trying to cause revolutions in similar trouble all over South America and all over Eastern Europe. Chase Manhattan was exposed in many places.
Is there anything that you've heard in the following years that might have confirmed or disconfirmed Bill's interpretation?
Book, there is a book written on that particular subject.
Yeah.
But I've never... And there was a long article in Playboy about 2 years ago.
Yeah. That is,
but other than that, I have the book here. Yeah. I really have a better idea for it. seems a little bit far-fetched.
Okay. Now, on November 1st, there was a big demonstration against the U.S. Admission of the Shah in Tehran. Apparently, after it was over, some embassy staff officials believe that the worst may well be over, that the demonstration was the worst.
That they had shot their wad.
Yeah. Was that your thinking as well, that this was the reaction that would occur and that would be it?
Honestly, I don't remember now.
Yeah.
I really do not remember. You know, there's a problem with the demonstration. When I tried to remember how I felt on a particular day, demonstrations were a way of life in Tehran. They went on every day about something or other, somewhere or other, whether it was against women not wearing the veil or women wearing the veil, or, you know, frozen meat as opposed to unfrozen, be quite literally.
Right.
Or you have Khomeini come out against frozen meat at one point, which led to a lot of butchering of fresh young lambs on the sidewalks. But demonstrations were going on all the time. Groups would form, there'd be fights, there'd be shooting. And it had been going on since the middle of 1978 in various forms. It just continued all through 1979. So one tended to get the reasons for demonstrations mixed up. And it was just when you saw one, you simply walked around it or turned the block earlier, lest you'd be caught up in it.
Yeah.
And the embassy was always a focus for demonstration.
Now, at the same time, on the November 1st demonstration, Khomeini was calling upon the students to attack the United States. Do you recall hearing about that?
But it wasn't the first time. Khomeini had been railing about the United States since the day he came to power.
But was there rhetoric that escalated in terms of saying we should attack the United States or its
I remember feeling
representatives?
This was going a lot farther. That's about it.
Yeah.
It certainly didn't stop my social life or my business life.
What do you recall the mood in Tehran for the next few days before the taking of the embassy? What anything striking going on, or just the things you were telling me?
Lots of street activity, Let's put it this way: what was going on in the city and in the country was not so outrageous that it stopped normal business. Even the day of the attack on the embassy, it was a normal business day in the embassy. We had lots of Iranian visitors in the embassy. The visa section was filled with people trying to get visas. I had appointments scheduled for the morning. I had a lunch appointment for 12 o'clock. I had a dinner appointment for that evening. And all of these had been made that day or the day before by normal Iranians with me. There was just no reason to think this day would be really different than any other day of business being carried out in a harried, noisy, sort of frenetic environment.
What are some of your recollections of what actually happened that day? Where were you at the time the students went over the wall, broke through the wall, the gates, I guess?
In my office, waiting for a couple of Iranians who had made an appointment with me. And basically started hearing noise. And realized pretty quickly that a mob was forming around the embassy. What I had done that morning specifically was to rewrap a gift that an Iranian had sent to me, which I did not want to accept because it was too valuable. And actually rather funny and very typical of Iranians, it's worth repeating. An Iranian professor, one of the revolutionary figures in Iran, without going into names, had asked me if I could help out a particular Iranian well-known professor and his family who wanted to get visas. Because of the person who asked me, who was well-known, and, as I say, a revolutionary personage, I arranged for their visas. The gentleman who got the visas, a former university president, called me up and said that he would like to come to my house to thank me. I agreed to let him come. He said that his wife wanted to meet me and his children before they left on their trip to the United States. He came to my house, and when he walked in, it was just a 5-minute courtesy call. But he had been so insistent that I said okay. And I was never averse to making more contacts. But when he came to the house, he handed me a large package, and he said, "This is from Isfahan." I thought it was a particular candy, since it was wrapped in the paper that the Isfahan candy was always wrapped in. I thought it was a particular candy that Isfahan was famous for called Gaz, which is a white nougat candy. And so I simply thanked him, put it on my kitchen table, where I had other boxes of candy and, you know, wrapped packages of candy and nuts and things of that sort, and didn't think about it. You know, about 2 days passed, or 3 days passed, and I had some more guests, and so I went back to the kitchen to get some candy to set up for the guests when they came in, unwrapped this, and discovered a huge sterling silver bowl. What a beautiful Isfahan bowl. But it was really funny, because I got so angry. I thought that I had the candy for the guests, and instead there's this massive piece of sterling silver. So I rewrapped it, wrote him a note of ending on that night, and said, "Thank you very much, but I can't accept this," et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the next day, took it to the embassy, called him, called his office, and explained that I would not be able to accept it, that I was leaving it at the front gate with the receptionist, and would he please come and pick it up? And he said that he would send someone to pick it up. So, I mean, that was the sort of day I was having. And then I had more people who were supposed to be coming in, et cetera, et cetera. It was otherwise a normal day. I've always wondered whether he got the ball. Because, anyway, there it was, a rather nice piece of sterling silver. So well.
Well, you heard the crowd assembling outside the embassy.
All around the embassy.
Yeah.
Looked out, and instead of the normal group of 10 or 20, there was just a sea of faces. And when I looked out, they were already over the walls, and, you know, crossing the yard. So I locked my safe and went over to what was to where everyone was gathering in the ambassador's area.
And then what happened?
The local employees and others were brought up to the main floor. We gathered on the second floor of the embassy, closed the doors behind us, gas masks were distributed, protected from tear gas. And the Marines took up position with weapons at the various windows. And we just waited. We were in communication with the Chargé, who was landing.
He was at the Foreign Ministry, right?
The Foreign Ministry. We had gotten to him by phone. We were in communication with a number of other officers. They all told us not to worry, things would straighten out. Help was on the way. The Imam was not going to let this happen. And all the other claptrap for which the Iranian government later became infamous. It took us a while to start burning documents and to start destroying things because we assumed that we'd locked up, of course. We simply assumed that this would be dispersed. It did not get dispersed.